We'll call the meeting to order. Members, we have three bills we will be hearing today. And if necessary, there's a chance we'll need to come back at 6 o'clock, but we'll get started as quickly as we can here. Representative Mack moves that House File 262 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Representative Mack, welcome. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed with your bill.
Mr. Chair, I am wondering, members should have a delete all amendment or delete everything amendment in their packets. And in order to get the bill in order, I'd like to move the DE2 amendment.
Your Representative Mack moves the DE2 amendment to House File 262. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And we now have the bill in the form you'd like to have it heard. And Representative Mack, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have one more oral amendment I would like to make. It's on page 2, lines 24 and 25. And the oral amendment is to delete Office of Rural Health and Primary Care and insert Commissioner of Health.
Okay, do we have that amendment? So on line 2.24, we are deleting the word office of the words Office of Rural Health, replacing it with Commissioner of Health, and deleting on line 2.25 the words and primary care.
Correct.
Okay. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Very good. I think it's now in the form you wanted in, Representative Mack.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill that was brought forward by the paramedic community. It's an issue that I think is going to really try to meet some of the needs that we've been trying to get at in terms of reducing costs in our healthcare service, getting the services to the people who need it where they need it most. And it introduces the concept of a community paramedic. This is an excellent example of what we have been seeking in the area of healthcare reform. It was brought to me by the Minnesota Ambulance Association. Granted, it represents a relatively modest proposal, but I feel that it is exactly what we have been asking the healthcare community to bring forward. It takes an underutilized resource and inserts it into the rural healthcare delivery system without negatively affecting the precious resources that we already have in rural Minnesota. Community paramedic is an initiative that sprung from the innovative thinking of the Mayo Clinic and has spread literally throughout the world. Ironically, we do not have this innovative provider network in place in the state where the program was initiated. This concept is simple. It connects underutilized resources to underserved populations. In this case, we're expanding the roles of experienced EMS personnel to provide health services where access to physicians, clinics, and/or hospitals is a significantly challenged or non-existent. Community paramedics would provide their care under the auspices of their employing ambulance service and under supervision of a physician. One of the strengths of community paramedic is their adaptability to needs of the local communities. What develops in Minnesota will be different than what other jurisdictions will implement. There is no one-size-fits-all. Services provided will vary depending on what is approved by the local ambulance medical director. It is truly a physician drive program that will collaborate with the community's public health system and other providers as part of a patient's overall care plan. In Fort Worth, Texas, which you have a couple handouts in your packet that highlight the program that has been implemented in Fort Worth, Texas, really implements and highlights the savings that have been experienced there and the better care to patients. But this program was initiated. There was a program that was initiated seeking to reduce inappropriate ER visits by a group of 64 identified individuals. The CP program reduced inappropriate hospital ER visits and 911 response by 67.4% in a matter of a year. Federal health care policy, which I believe takes effect in 2012, has reimbursement disincentives for hospitals that readmit patients with the same diagnosis for which they were treated within the previous month. In addition, under current state law for MA services rendered on or effective in July, the commissioner shall include as part of the performance targets a reduction in the state's emergency room utilization rate for health care programs, program enrollees by a measurable rate of 5% from the plan's utilization rate for the previous calendar year. So this is hopefully getting at some of this and helping to prevent some of those things that are going to be coming down in potential health care reform. The delete all amendment in front of you today does the following, and I'll just quick highlight what it does and then turn it over to our testifier to shed a little bit more light on this particular issue in the curriculum involved with becoming a community paramedic.
Thank you, Representative Mack. Just one moment. First of all, I'd like to have somebody move our minutes from February 15th yesterday. Anybody? Moved by Representative Kiffmeyer. Any comments on the minutes? Any changes or amendments? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And we have the minutes approved. And just one announcement to all the people here in the room. If we reach the point where we're at capacity, because I know we have a couple of other bills that people have some strong interest in, we do have an overflow room down in the lower part of this building. It's called Room 10. You'd be able to watch the proceedings on video. So once this place is filled, if other people want to come in, we want to be able to accommodate them and give them a chance to watch the proceedings as well. That would be in Room 10 down in the basement of this building. Representative Mack, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just briefly, the delete all amendment before you today does the following. It identifies a community paramedic in the statutes. It requires that they have a minimum of 2 years full-time experience as a paramedic to be eligible to enroll in the CPA training program. Candidates must successfully complete an approved training program accredited and offered by MNSCU. Community paramedic services may only be provided through licensed ambulance services. Payment for services will be made to the licensed ambulance service based on a fee schedule determined by DHS with input from the EMS community. They may only provide care for, the CPs may only provide care for which they have been trained and has been approved by the ambulance services physician's medical director. And discipline will be handled by the EMS regulatory board in the same manner as paramedics. So that is a general overview of what is covered in the bill. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to our testifier.
Very good. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Dr. Wilcox?
That is correct.
Very good. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, it's certainly my pleasure to have the opportunity to come and be a part of your work here today. My name is Mike Wilcox. I'm a family practice physician who's practiced in New Prague, Minnesota, which is about 65 miles from here. I've been there since 1973, so I've had a unique opportunity to spend my entire medical career in a rural setting. During this time, I've had the opportunity to provide family medical care for about 19 or 20 years. Thereafter, I've gone ahead and done primarily emergency care, again, in rural settings throughout the southern part of our state. I've also had a unique opportunity during this time to be a medical director of several EMS units throughout the southern part of the state in particular. And that is part of the reason that I'm here today to discuss with you what I feel to be a unique opportunity to use our EMS providers to provide a higher level of care within the communities in which they serve. As I have suggested to you, the opportunity is there, I believe, to train our seasoned paramedics to actually do additional patient care within the communities in which they reside. They could do so by becoming certified to be a community paramedic. It would give them the opportunity to complete a course of study, and under their physician's medical license, they could go back into their individual communities and provide ongoing patient care based upon what the community needs are of health care and within their areas of work. Each of these paramedics, of course, would go through a curriculum that is a universal curriculum. This is the curriculum MNSCU has adopted for the coursework that we're talking about. And as I mentioned to you, it's actually a universal curriculum. So that if these folks were trained to become community paramedics, they could actually move from our state do work in other states within the United States, in particular Colorado, North Carolina, South Carolina, Nebraska are presently looking at this type of provider as well. And also, they could actually go internationally. They could do work overseas, areas such as Canada, Australia, which have a large rural base, could utilize these folks to do the work within their areas as well. So it is a standard curriculum and a universal curriculum that all of these folks would achieve. Now, I suggest to you that we need this type of provider for a number of reasons, but I can suggest to you the main reason is we have a problem in access in health care in our rural communities. And this access to health care is becoming especially more problematic as our populations age and as we have more immigrant folks and culturally diverse folks who are entering our society who tend to gravitate to these rural areas as well. We're also faced with the fact that, unfortunately, we have a large number of folks who are uninsured, and these folks need access to health care, which so far we've been unable to provide for them in a manner that's appropriate. So my feeling is that the community paramedic could certainly answer many of these issues, and if utilized correctly, I believe it would be best for patient care, and not only best for patient care, but economically most sound to consider this type of provider and allowing them to do the work that they would undertake. I can tell you that we've already had a pilot group of providers who have gone through a preliminary course. We have 8 providers who are now ready or just about ready to be certified to achieve this level of their training. And I've actually utilized these folks in some of the work that I do in the southern part of the state to provide health care, especially for folks who have been unable to obtain it because of insurance issues and so on. We have had a project ongoing in Scott County for the last year and a half. We actually have a mobile clinic that we provide access to health care within Scott County for folks who cannot afford this care. We've gone into a partnership with the Mattawakoneta Sioux community in Scott County who has a mobile clinic that they've allowed us to use. We then provide staffing for this mobile clinic, public health nurse, sometimes 2 public health nurses, one of our paramedics, a community paramedic, and a physician or a PA nurse practitioner actually provide health care every 2 weeks around the county for folks who cannot achieve health care because of access issues. It's been a very successful program, I might suggest to you, and I believe it could be a model for other counties within Minnesota who might need to achieve something similar to this. It's been a great opportunity for me to work with some terrific people. I can tell you as a medical director for EMS organizations throughout the southern part of the state, I've been impressed with the level of skill and expertise they have available to them. And a lot of these folks are volunteers, but they've trained up to an EMS level to provide adequate EMS coverage for their home communities. And this type of provider, this community paramedic provider, could certainly add to that type of EMS provision as well. I can see these sorts of folks actually doing this work when they're not responding to a 911 call. We talk about utilization of healthcare resources within our communities. There's absolutely no reason at all why these EMS providers, between 911 calls, why they couldn't actually go out and do one-on-one healthcare for folks who are in need of this, especially folks who have chronic disease processes that need oversight. I would suggest to you that folks who have heart-related issues, chronic obstructive lung disease, diabetic complications, issues of that type, mental health issues, could certainly be properly handled with medical director supervision in their communities by using a provider of this type.
And Dr. Wilcox, we have a question from one of our members, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Wilcox, thank you for being here today. It's an exciting new kind of way of delivering services from some highly skilled personnel and to make greater use of them, and thank you, Representative Mack, for shepherding it through. But Dr. Wilcox, the question I have for you, and I don't know if you're the right person, but what is the payment system for these sorts of things? I mean, the policy looks good and sound. Just sure. Quickly, it's not a finance committee, so just quickly.
You know, that's a great question, Representative. I tell you, up to this point, the folks who have been involved in these pilot projects have been paid by grants. Grants which tend to be there for a time and then they disappear. And the problem is when these grants disappear, there's no ongoing revenue stream for these individuals to continue to do their work. So I applaud our state in looking at this opportunity to provide a revenue stream for these individuals to be paid for the work they do on an ongoing ongoing basis in particular.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Wilcox. Is it correct that EMS providers are currently functioning under the delegated authority of physicians?
That is correct.
Dr. Wilcox.
That is correct.
Thank you, Dr. Wilcox. And so this would
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would then be an extension of that same model?
That is correct.
Dr. Wilcox.
Their role, Mr. Chair. The role of this EMS provider would be, their role in the work in which they provide EMS care within the community would be expanded. That is correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Wilcox. The legislation doesn't really enumerate or explain at all what the bounds of the practice of the new provider would be. So can you give us some examples of what this new provider may or may not be able to do in the community under this revision of a physician's license?
Certainly I can.
Dr. Wilcox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I tell you, the curriculum that's in place, I think, nicely outlines some of the opportunities these providers could explore as they get back into the communities in which they do their service. One of the components of this curriculum is that these providers who actually live in the communities, who provide care in the communities, who know the resources healthcare-wise within their communities, one of the requirements would be to complete their curriculum that they would have to go back to the communities, do a community assessment of what the healthcare needs are, and then develop a plan that would address those needs and work out a plan that would address those needs in conjunction with the other health care providers within the community that are already in place. Okay, so they would actually come back and develop opportunities for care relative to chronic disease management, for example. If they had a community that seemed to have a heavy problem, say, with diabetic issues. Some of our communities, unfortunately, are dealing more and more with that. They would develop a strategy in conjunction with the other healthcare resources within the community to address those issues, not only handling the disease itself, but also hopefully doing some educational pieces in preventing the disease from progressing within the community. That would be one example. You may have, as another example, a community that ends up having a major problem with trauma of various types, depending upon where their community is located. And these individuals could actually address that issue with some community education, hopefully do some educational pieces that would prevent trauma from becoming more of a problem in those communities. Those would be examples of what they might be able to provide for their communities if there was an issue of that type.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Wilcox, as I'm looking at the handout, community health care and emergency cooperative, talking about the community paramedic, and I look at the role, and I'm a registered nurse, so when I look at the things that are on this list, a number of them, I think, are things that took me the 4 years of my baccalaureate program to know how to do, plus a lot of clinical practice. So I'm just a little worried about the preparation for this position. And then just one final question, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
On the second page, line 2.3, here we're talking about patient care planning, and it requires that the community paramedic be included in patient care planning. I'm a little curious about that, only in that patient care plans are drafted by providers, and the providers are the ones that know the best, so that through statute to say that they must be included seems a little heavy-handed, and I'm wondering if Representative Mack, I think if you'd be willing to consider switching that must to a may.
Representative Mack.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Murphy, that question was brought to our attention and that concern, and are certainly willing to fix that, whether it will be to maybe or the terminology, but that's certainly something we intend to change before it goes to the next committee.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mack, would you be willing to entertain a friendly amendment right now?
Sure, let's hear what the amendment suggestion is.
Okay, Representative Murphy,
oral amendment. I would move that on line 2.3 that we would delete the word must and insert the word may. And I would offer that as an amendment because I think that care planning is best done by the providers in conjunction with the patient in their care.
Okay, let's make sure we have the amendment. We're on line 2.3 of the HO 262D2 amendment, and we're deleting the word must and replacing it with the word may. Okay, do we have that clear? Representative Mack, do you want to speak to the amendment as well?
No, Mr. Chair, only that. No problem with that. I agree with Representative Murphy. It is a bit heavy-handed to have that it must be included. So I think it's the right direction we want to go.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those against?
Nay.
Okay, and the amendment is adopted. We have Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mack and Mr. Wilcox, a question for you. Oftentimes in rural areas, of course, the first responders, the fire department, are some of the first responders, and I know in the case of my hometown of Delano, they've indeed saved lives. Have you thought about perhaps extending this to the first responders or seeing if you could increase their role greater in reducing costs, but more importantly, saving lives? Mr. Chairman?
Dr. Wilcox?
You know, I think we're looking at different ways in which we can utilize our EMS resources to the fullest, no matter what size the community might be. And certainly, if we had a trained community paramedic who was living within that community, who was functioning as a member of a first responder unit, and had medical direction that would support the ongoing expertise of this person to provide that skill set for that community, that certainly could be something that would be looked at.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, then how would that look, Mr. Wilcox? I do know of some first responders on the fire department that are EMS paramedics. How does that look if they are responding on a fire call or emergency call? How would that look then if they were able to do the same thing that this bill asks us to do?
You know, Representative, I believe what would have to occur is they'd have to be a member of the local ambulance service also in order to provide this type of skill set for that community. And there'd be ways in which we already do that. Frequently we'll have first responder units around a transport ambulance service that actually become members of that unit and can function then as an ambulance transport individual as well. And it seems to me that this kind of a model could work very nicely in that setting also. As this bill stands right now, however, to be reimbursed for services, the members that are working would need to, doing a community paramedic type of venue, would have to be a member of a licensed ambulance service in order to be properly billing for that service.
Representative McDonald, very good. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this topic, I have consulted with many first responders, and sometimes they're separate first responders from fire departments. Members of the first responders can have a varying degree of training. In fact, my local squad has a physician, some paramedics, some EMTs, and others that have just gone through their first responding. And when I took this language to them, they didn't want to have additional onus put on them and creep scope of their activities because they locally interact with an ambulance service. And that I agree with the present language, and I don't think it prohibits service, but then again, you've got to have the appropriate equipment, and this is aimed for assisting in expanding some capabilities in, you know, public health, community health, as opposed to an emergency response. And I think when you're in an emergency situation, you need extremely well delineated parameters on what you're doing. And so I guess I support this present language as opposed to trying to blend it.
Very good. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, unless there's no further questions at this point, I think...
Okay, I think we have additional witnesses. Ms. Hamilton, Linda Hamilton, with the Minnesota Nurses Association. And if you're here to testify in this bill, it would be helpful if you just want to start kind of queuing up behind the witness table. That would be great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Linda Hamilton. I am a registered nurse practicing at Children's Hospitals and Clinics in Minneapolis. I am here in my role as president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. We represent 20,000 nurses in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify. The MNA strongly supports increasing access to health care for all Minnesotans, and we support the role of community health worker in helping to reach underserved populations. Conceptually, we support the idea of the community paramedic, but we have a number of concerns with the legislation as it is currently written. We create new roles for healthcare workers, and we believe policymakers should raise a number of questions to ensure the goal of patient safety is met. These questions include, what is the education and training requirements of the community paramedic? Who is the appropriate licensed healthcare professional to supervise the community paramedic? How is that care being coordinated within the existing healthcare delivery system? And how do we avoid duplication of services and payment for these new roles? At this point, we do not believe the legislation adequately addresses these questions to garner our support. We are very concerned that paramedics who are trained to stabilize patients for transport do not have adequate training and background to do chronic disease monitoring and treatment. This bill extends the job functions of a paramedic into the scope of the licensed registered nurse without adequate supervision from a professional nurse. How is the role of community paramedic not public health nursing without a nursing license? Under the current statute for community health workers, the provision of care is limited to care coordination and patient education. We believe that chronic disease monitoring is outside this role of community paramedics, and it should be studied. Allowing community paramedics to do chronic disease management raises a number of questions regarding how that care will be coordinated and supervised. Is it the emergency room doctor or the medical director who owns the ambulance service that will develop the care plan? Will it be the same community paramedic for each visit? We know that relationships in chronic illness are very, very important to assure that, in fact, people are following the plan of care. At one point, we were informed that this bill was better utilize health care professionals who had downtime between emergencies. So how can we guarantee continuity of care for patients when an emergency happens, and if that's a community paramedic's primary role? Also, the bill requires community paramedics to work under the direction of a medical director or physician. Well, these physicians are trained and qualified in trauma and emergency care, they may not necessarily know the unique needs of this patient, and they do not see regularly or be knowledgeable in the best practice for a given chronic disease. Finally, we need to be assured that the community paramedics are integrated within our current health system to work with local providers, health care homes, public health agencies, and home care agencies, to name just a few. Without a clear understanding of the different roles, we feel this bill will further fragment the care of our community and create ambiguity to our consumers and providers alike. Ultimately, this may result in higher health care costs. I would also ask, what kind of payment is required or is expected from the medical director who directs the program, and how will that be managed? We remain willing to work with the stakeholders to address these issues, but at this time, we really do not support what is in front of us until these questions are answered. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hamilton, for your testimony today. I want to preface my remarks by saying that my mother was a LPN and worked in third shift emergency room for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so she unfortunately saw a lot in her time as in a third shift emergency room nurse. But I'd like, if you could, ma'am, could you paint a couple scenarios regarding what a person in that position might see on the extreme end of patient care, and then maybe on the other end where we have people coming in using the emergency medical area and ambulances for things that are determined not to be urgent. So I'd like to understand from both perspectives how often each happens in that scenario.
If you could, thank you, Representative.
Ms. Hamilton.
Sorry. I can give you an example of my father lives in Todd County. He has many chronic illnesses right now that he is dealing with. And in his home, he receives care, and that keeps him at home. When, you know, this role may be very useful in monitoring his progress if they report to, like a nurse in his case, the person that comes to the home calls the nurse decides, oh, I think we maybe need to call the cardiologist, or I think maybe social service needs to get involved, or physical therapy. She's making decisions around this, and in this particular bill right now, I don't see that as happening right now, as this bill is taking this person that's obtaining the information, and it's all going to an emergency room doctor, who I'm not sure is the right person to do that work. And on, do we see emergency room visits that are unnecessary or calls to the paramedics? Perhaps, and I'm not going to say we don't. There we need to study what is our access to health care in the home, and how is that working? Are patients being assessed to determine if the home environment is working for them? What help do they need in the home to keep them there? Many times it's a matter of education, and who to best provide that education is part of the work that a nurse who visits the home or the patient's primary physician is, that's part of their care. And I see that kind of gets between that relationship between somebody that understands the entire coordination of care and somebody who is their primary care provider.
Representative Barrett.
Sure, just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Well, I guess the line of my questioning is related to the scenario where an ambulance is present and they do have to make decisions, and you had admitted that in certain cases that there isn't a true emergency. I'm wondering how your scenario would work in that environment where quick decisions need to be made fairly quickly and they need to be made at the home or other place. I'm wondering how a scenario would work
related to this scenario
we're trying to accomplish, or people are trying to accomplish, where we reduce the cost yet provide the quality care that we all need and deserve. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hamilton.
I believe I'm understanding your question, and that certainly if someone calls 911 and a rig goes out to that house, they will do an emergency assessment of that patient and decide whether who they need to be contacting and what their algorithm of care is. There's no doubt paramedics have an integral part of our healthcare system. I'm not saying at all that they don't. But what I'm saying is that if we're going to keep people at the best they can be in their homes, that we need to have somebody coordinating that care. That will cost us less money, I believe, than just sending somebody out without the back, without the support that they need to do the work that is necessary. And I do believe you do need to have a nurse or somebody that is deciding, or primary care practitioner, who can make those decisions about who's best to do it. It just kind of makes sense. And I don't see really where every time they go out, it's an emergency visit. Hopefully. That would be my hope.
Representative Barrett.
Did that answer?
Yes. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hamilton. It might be because I've been involved in the process when they were creating this. And, you know, I've had discussions with my wife who worked as a nurse in a general practice office. And is a member of the first responders and has been with several volunteer ambulance services. But in the bill, in the language, it does delineate minimum amount of actual experience, you know, patient contact. And this is set up specifically, and it's underneath an existing program for community health. So it's under community health. It's under a doctor's order. It's planned. It's scheduled. This is routine. And that the personnel, besides going through additional specialized training for community paramedic, they're used to being able to push meds, take vitals, obtain medical, pertinent medical information by observation and questioning, and that they are used to understanding that I may need to bring a, you know, talk to a cardiologist or some other specialist, because they're used to coming into a situation and having to analyze, you know, a broad range of possibilities. So I think what we're doing is we're just taking somebody that's local, that's available, that's got the skill set, bringing them up educational-wise, and then allowing them to provide care in many areas where it's tens of miles, it could be, you know, hours to get to a facility to be able to see the normal care provider. So, I mean, if you look at the bill, we really would like to have you speak with the, you know, the author and the people involved in crafting it, because I do know this is probably at least the eighth iteration to try and improve. And I understand where your concerns are, and I might not have those concerns since I've been holding those conversations, but if I can be of assistance in helping you understand that, or I assume there's others here. Thank you.
Ms. Hamilton, any response?
I think that the supervision of the care and the care coordination is the function that is really where we have a lot of questions, and about the training and how we don't, those are maybe questions, and that we have not said we will never support this. What we are saying is, in its present form right now, it doesn't answer our questions. There's too many questions, and we don't believe it addresses them.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hamilton, I'm just wondering here, with the bill in its present form, are you afraid or worried about the impact that the jobs factor, is this playing into any part that this form of help would take away from jobs in the nursing field?
The rural areas.
Ms. Hamilton.
Sorry, I keep forgetting. The rural areas right now have a need for public nursing. There is no doubt about that. And they also need to have people that can help them do the work that needs to be done. And in saying that, that work can't be. Nursing is a skill, it is a job, it has a scope of practice that is unique. And in the job of nursing, it is not the job of medicine. We have different licenses, we have different boards that determine our practice. We, in saying that our practice is that, and we're willing to, in fact, we always delegate where appropriate, and but we can't give away the center part of our work, if that's what you mean, because that is what we're best at. That is what the patients are entitled to.
Okay. I believe you're going to talk, any follow-up
on that, aren't you?
Okay, we have an additional witness lined up, Renee Cronquist.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
I will do so, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Renee Cronquist, and I'm the Director for Practice and Policy at the Minnesota Board of Nursing. I will keep my comments here today brief. The Board of Nursing was not involved in the development of this bill, but I do understand from today that there have been many, many iterations. So my comments really are based primarily on just a plain read of the bill, of which I understand there are various versions. And so I hope that my comments about some of the specific language are on point to the version that you have in front of you. Let me say at the outset that the critical need to provide greater access to care and health services to the underserved and rural populations is not disputed. Additionally, innovative and creativity in finding new ways to meet those needs with the limited pool of public health nurses and primary care providers is certainly to be supported and encouraged. So my comments should not be taken to minimize that need or to minimize the innovation that's identified here. With that said, my intent of the comments is really to just raise a few questions about the proposal as it is written. The first point would be that the role and the scope of the community paramedic seems to be rather ill-defined. That is, the portion that would amend Chapter 114E to create this credential does not outline a scope of practice or place any parameters on what may or may not be performed by the community paramedic. The portion of the bill that describes the services that might be covered by medical assistance, the reimbursement portion, suggests some of the functions that the community paramedic might perform. Although the services are identified as not exclusive, it further leaves some ambiguity about the scope and role of the community paramedic. The functions that are identified, I believe, are indistinguishable from nursing. I raise this not as a turf concern, that's not the role of the Board of Nursing, but as a safety concern. Providers and consumers need to be able to know what to expect from various types of caregivers. The function that is included in the provision that's most concerning is the chronic disease monitoring and treatment. It's quite unclear from the bill as drafted what exactly that means. In nursing, the expectation of the Board of Nursing would be that chronic disease management is a function of a master's prepared advanced practice registered nurse. As Ms. Hamilton identified, it's also quite clear from the bill as drafted how the coordination and continuity of care would be provided. This is not the episodic, time-limited care that's typically provided by a paramedic or an EMS or a first responder. This suggests some ongoing care, and again, how that care is coordinated is quite unclear from the bill. The final issue or question that I would raise is ensuring the competence of the individuals that would be functioning as a community paramedic. Again, well established the credentials and preparation of a paramedic. This is a quite different role and function, it would appear. My understanding is that the expectation is that the individuals who would function this role would have completed an accredited program, but there's nothing that would require any demonstration of competence by that individual in this very new and unique role. It's unclear whether they would be required to take some sort of an examination, whether they would need to demonstrate ongoing competence. I don't even know if such mechanisms exist. So again, given this very different role, it seems quite critical that those safety pieces be in place. And with that, I'll be open to questions.
Okay, members, we have two more bills to get to. I have no other testifiers listed. Are there other people willing to testify? And in the meantime, members, any questions for the testifier? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Ms. Cronquist, I'm just a consumer of healthcare. I don't have a degree in any of this, and I cherish the fact that other people served on a licensing committee when we used to have one to wade into this stuff. But as a consumer, we're adding another title on, and that's an emergency medical technician, community paramedic. And I have to just say, as a consumer, when we keep multiplying all these titles, some of which require four-year degrees, some of which require master's degrees, some of which require board demonstrated techniques, which I think is standard to almost all medical professions, as Ms. Cronquist mentioned. I'm totally supportive of mid-level practitioners expanding the wealth of people who can take over and practice at the highest point of their license, so that people who have those master level preparation, don't have to do things that someone with just a 2 years of preparation need to do. But as people in the audience bring forward these bills, I challenge you all to work with academia to come out with something that can actually communicate to the patient what to expect from who as their care is being handled. And this one does feel to me like it doesn't have the breadth and depth of specificity that I'm used to seeing things that came out of the licensing committee. And I'm hoping that some of those issues that have been raised by the last witness in terms of just being a lot clearer will evolve on this bill, Representative Mack, because I do think that's kind of the standard expectation of just definitions of terms and things. And it's not against the concept. It's just I think it adds to the confusion. And my hope in all of this is that we're actually reducing the cost of healthcare and not just adding, you know, another set of players who can bill. And I don't think that's the intent of the bill in any way. But I do think that as we get more and more people who want to change their scope, I hope we kind of stay to a standard of expectation of clarity. And so it's just a statement, not a comment. But I do know that there are others who are creatively thinking up new professions and expansions of current professions. And if they could all work together, it'd help me with my confusion.
Okay, thank you. Representative Grinhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Dr. Wilcox. He wants to come back down there.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Wilcox, I'm not in the medical profession. I'm a layperson. But when I look at this bill, I see in subdivision 5F, you know, they're already a part of a licensed ambulance service. I mean, if I have a terrible accident or something, you know, acute problem, and by the way, I did once in my life, and the ambulance came out, and it was three EMTs that loaded me up in the ambulance. And they did a very nice job. But anyway, so they're already used to coming out. They've got a certain level of experience. Okay, again, I'm just looking at it as a layperson. They, you know, they have to have 2 years, and we require this, you know, degree or certification. And then I go back to the paramedical services under Section 3, Subdivision 5, and basically what you have is a situation that possibly could be of an emergency nature, but we're allowing them to go out there to a home or whatever, and to possibly take the necessary steps to avoid an ambulance visit. And I think with that type of background, you know, as a potential patient or past patient, I'm comfortable with that type of expertise assessing my situation. Or tell me where I'm going wrong on that. Sure. Dr. Wilcox.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Dr. Wilcox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to address some of the issues that were brought up by our previous folks who testified. Let me say the community paramedic will go through a curriculum that brings their skill level to the point where they're certified as community paramedics. It's a universal curriculum that is going to be used across MNSCU's system and across other college systems within our country. So the curriculum that they will be trained to is a universal curriculum. These providers will function under a medical director's license. And as part of that, a medical director is expected to make sure that the skill set of those paramedics is to a level that's the best for patient care that can be achieved. And they will receive ongoing reevaluations on a quarterly basis to make sure that that is the case. So their skill set certainly will be monitored closely. I would also suggest to you that when we talk about oversight, to be sure, there will be a medical director for the ambulance service that will provide oversight for this provider. However, as they get back to their communities, they will be part of the healthcare team within that community. And I can give you as an example, a patient perhaps who is evaluated by one of our CPs who is having some cardiac issues and perhaps medications need to be adjusted. What they would do at that point is interact with the primary care physician of that patient in that community to determine what could be done to further manage this process. And if it necessitates a hospital admission, fine. If it necessitates a clinic visit in a timely manner, fine. If it if they can adjust medications by phone, that's correct too. So it gives them that opportunity. They're a part of that local community's healthcare team, and they would achieve interaction with that patient's primary care provider, be it a physician, nurse practitioner, PA, whatever.
Thank you, Doctor. That's all. Thank
Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Doctor, I have listened to some of the other comments, and it almost has sounded to me that it has supposed that this service was going to be substituted instead of the attendance by a visiting nurse. But I don't see that anywhere in the bill, and I would like clarification because I don't see that as being the case.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Dr. Wilcox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct. What these providers would do is determine what other health care resources they have in their communities, and they'd work with those resource people. So if indeed public health nursing is a part of that process, they would be interacting with them and working together with them as a team to provide the best possible patient care for that patient in that community. That's exactly correct.
Representative McElfatrick. Our Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is bringing back really good memories of the licensing subcommittee of the last 4 years.
Wishing you were back on it.
Well, no, I was, I'll leave that alone. As I look at the draft before us, Representative Mack's draft, and I have to say I worked on the community health worker legislation, and so I understand the concept here and have been supportive of it in the past, but the language is pretty open right now. So it's hard to know, if we're talking about paramedics doing professional nursing work, if paramedics are an extension of physicians, if paramedics are doing paramedic work. I mean, if I was with my nursing colleagues in an ambulance and we were, driving the rig to get somebody, I mean, I think we could probably rescue somebody, but I'm not going to be as good as a paramedic, right? I'm just not going to do it as well. And a paramedic's not going to practice nursing as well as a group of nurses would, and nurses aren't going to be physicians. We're all different. That's what's hard about licensing, because we overlap, but we're separate and we're different disciplines. So I think before I can vote for the legislation, I need to see some tightening and some clarity about the scope of the community paramedic, so I understand where the work of the paramedic ends and the work of the professional nurse begins and how those things fit together. So I'm not opposed to the concept, but it's just not clear enough yet for me. And I know there's been some work done in the Senate, and I understand there's been some work done with the paramedics and the nurses, and I think that's really great. So keep working on it. And I think we can make some headway.
Could I make one comment, Mr. Chair? Relative to
Dr. Wilcox.
Thank you. What I'd like to emphasize is we're not changing the scope of practice of the paramedic. We're expanding the role of the paramedic in what they do already. And they're doing this under a medical director's licensure. So the medical director will not sign off on the skill set that these individuals would hope to achieve without making sure that they have been trained to a level that's acceptable to them, because their medical license truly is on the line.
Is there anyone else interested in testifying on this bill, House File 262? Anyone else interested in testifying? If not, I'll make just a brief comment that we are looking for help out in the rural areas in providing primary care. And I know we have shortages of both primary care physicians and nurses in those areas. And so I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. Representative Mack renews her motion that House File 262 pass and as amended and be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
And the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Mack. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that House File 199 pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. And Madam Chair, I'd like to open up by making an amendment, an oral amendment. This is an amendment to remove Section 3 of the bill, lines 3.12 through 3.16.
Okay, members, Ms. Representative Gottwalt moves the amendment that lines 3.12 through lines 3.16 be removed from the bill. Any discussion? Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, for the members, this is the part of the bill that repeals the early enrollment and medical assistance, and which will bring in about $1 billion of federal money to our health care providers. So I strongly urge you to repeal or get rid of this section of the bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gottwalt.
That isn't exactly the reason I'm bringing the amendment, but I do realize it has fiscal implications, and because of that, we want to focus on the primary purpose of this bill. So I would again encourage all members to vote in favor of this amendment.
Any further discussion, members? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment, verify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Gottwalt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill. Members, Madam Chair, members, House File 199, the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act, is Minnesota's Declaration of Independence from the unconstitutional provisions of the so-called Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. Our mantra throughout this session has been the critical need to protect Minnesota's lead in healthcare and healthcare reform. Our state has the lowest costs on average and best outcomes of almost any other state in the nation. We have among the highest percentage of our residents with access to health care coverage. And we've made huge strides in the areas of health technologies, data, and transparency. Our friends in Washington acknowledge Minnesota stands head and shoulders above the rest of the nation in terms of health care and health care reform. On behalf of all Minnesotans, we must not surrender our health care leadership. And while we know there are many areas in which we need to improve to provide greater access to higher quality and more cost-effective health care, we know Minnesota has the ability to get there without a massive federal government takeover of health care and insurrection of states and individuals' rights. The Obamacare legislation also raises serious concerns across many and broad fronts. The constitutionality issues are foundational to our democracy and demand the utmost deference and respect. House File 199 declares that Obamacare's individual mandate and penalties associated with it are outside the powers given to government under our U.S. Constitution. And by the way, that's a Constitution which each of us has sworn to uphold. All Americans should be concerned about the appropriate role of our government in light of this imperial legislation. As a matter of state policy, this bill clearly states those powers are ours, not the federal government's. It states that Minnesota exercises its sovereign power to declare the public policy of the state regarding the right of persons to choose the mode of securing health care services. It declares that it is the public policy of the state that every person within the state is and shall be free to choose or decline any mode of securing health care services without penalty or threat of penalty. House File 199 further prohibits state officials from enforcing such federal mandates or penalties, and it directs our Minnesota Attorney General to act on our behalf in defending our state's rights and to remove us from any unfunded mandate resulting from Obamacare. And then there are the innumerable concerns about what the Obamacare legislation will do to Minnesota's health care system. I have provided several handouts that detail some of these concerns, ranging from unsustainable cost increases for states and overwhelming bureaucracies, elimination of choice and rationing, to destruction of the private health care coverage market in favor of an all-out federal government takeover of health care. The Congressional Budget Office has already indicated the federal legislation as passed, will add billions of dollars to the total cost of health care in our nation. And many of us are convinced it grossly underestimates and understates the real total impacts. Madam Chair and members, I do not offer this bill lightly. We are at a critical crossroads on the issues surrounding true health care reform and the legitimate role of government. We have an obligation to the citizens of Minnesota to protect their legitimate interests and powers under the Constitution, and particularly in the area of health care. I urge you to stand up for Minnesotans and support the Minnesota Freedom of Choice in Health Care Act. And Madam Chair, with that, I'll open it up for questions. We also have a number of testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Gottwalt. Questions? Representative Peterson. Sorry, I drew a blank for a second.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to ask Representative Gottwalt, and actually, I'm not sure where I am on the federal health care issue, but I kept hearing the reference to Obamacare. Is that the real term of it? Is that the real name of the bill? Because it offends me just a little bit to have that repeated time and time again. Now, whether I agree, and I've already said, I don't know whether I agree or don't agree with the bill, but I think we call it in this body by its correct name, and I don't know what that is. Maybe that's what it is, but I'm not sure.
Thank you. And briefly, to members of the audience, please keep comments and side effects to yourselves as this is a committee hearing, and for members at the table to stay focused. Representative Gottwald, in response.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, I believe I started right off by calling it the so-called Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act.
Okay.
It is also referred to as the ACA, and numerous media outlets and others have referred to it consistently as Obamacare. So I understand that may be offensive to some people, but it is a very commonly used term which helps people understand exactly what legislation we're talking about. So I don't mean offense by referring to it as that. I think it's been referred to that by people from no particular persuasion and from both sides of the aisle.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gottwalt, I think that we have to use the correct names in here. I agree. It certainly has been used in the public by that name. But here, where we're discussing legislative issues, I think we have to use the correct terminology. Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have is there going to be a fiscal note on this, or without the repealer, is it cost neutral?
Representative Gottwalt.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, my understanding is with Section 3 removed, there is no fiscal impact.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to follow up a little bit on Representative Peterson's comment and just say that, you know, we should also recognize we sometimes hear people talk about this as the legislation. This is actually the law, and we need to understand that this is the law of the land. And just to respond briefly to Representative Gottwalt's opening comment about all of us taking an oath to uphold the Constitution, I believe that this is constitutional, that the Affordable Care Act is constitutional, and so under my oath to uphold the Constitution, I would need to oppose this legislation.
Representative Gottwalt. Okay, any other questions at the moment?
Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I had a follow-up to my question, but we can get back to me after Representative Kiffmeyer.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Could you go ahead and follow up? I know that's
okay. Very polite.
Your train of thought.
Thank you. Representative Norton with a follow-up.
Yeah, I guess I'd ask the question about finances, and I appreciate the bit about the repealer. Once that's gone, we save money. But as I understand it, this, if we would move ahead with this particular bill, it could wind up to be challenged. I mean, I think your motion is that this might be challenged in the Supreme Court, and will there not be a cost then to the state of Minnesota to have to defend this?
Representative Gottwalt?
Because it does address the Attorney General. I'm sorry, in the bill. You have language about that.
Representative Gottwalt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative Norton, I'm not aware that any language in the bill constitutes a fiscal noted, you know, increase in state spending. We could speculate about what might happen, but it simply declares our intent to, as I mentioned, declare independence from some of the onerous provisions, in fact, which would direct individuals to force them, in fact, to purchase health care coverage within
an insurance exchange, and then if they don't, face certain penalties. There are actually costs that may be associated with that as well, but my understanding is within the bill, we're not seeing any fiscal impact.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Norton.
Thank you very much. Well, I would direct you to line 2.20, where it does direct the Attorney General shall take any action as is provided in this section. I guess in times of tough fiscal situations, which we certainly are in this state and this nation, that we should be very careful about moving legislation forward that is going to waste precious dollars. So I just would urge you to think about this in light of the state's fiscal situation.
Madam Chair, and members, briefly.
Representative Botwell.
Duties assigned to the AG's office fall under the AG's budget, and if there are additional fiscal impacts, that would be dealt with at a later point. Most of that's fairly speculative at this point, but again, we are using this bill to lay out state policy, and we have states' rights that frankly trump the federal law.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to constitutionality, we have at this time two judges, Judge Vinson and Judge Hudson, who have both ruled on the constitutionality. Now, we do have two other judges who ruled in favor. So we have two for two at this point, and it's probably on its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But we are not authorized as legislators necessarily. We have opinions in regards to this. But certainly, just to make some comments here from the courts to substantiate Representative Gutwalt's bill, in regards to Judge Vincent making the statement that Congress has no authority to force Americans to buy a particular product, such as health insurance. And if they can force us to buy that kind of product, then what other kind of product could they force us to buy, or other intrusions could they do? I think it's interesting that Judge Hudson ruled that the individual mandate, not just unconstitutional, but also dangerous, because it would invite unbridled exercise of federal police powers. Now, this is judges who are sitting in high judicial benches making these kinds of statements. And matter of fact, in regards to Judge Vinson, rule the mandate didn't pass muster because severability from the rest of Obamacare, and that therefore the entire law is unconstitutional, must be declared void. Now, this was a lawsuit, I believe 24, 26 states were involved in. So that's pretty substantial when states are standing up and saying and appealing this and getting to this point. Certainly, we here in Minnesota have the state opportunity. We have the right to have our say in regards to this as a state. And so it is very appropriate for us as a legislature, the policy-setting body, to be able to make a statement here in regards to how we feel this law affects our state. This is Minnesota. And so I think at this time it is very appropriate for this bill to be in front of us and for us to be having this discussion. But we are not judges, and so we're not in that situation, but we are entitled to an opinion in regards to what we are taking in action here. But there are some other handouts that are in your packet as well that have more details. So, Madam Chair, I would definitely support this bill, and thank you, Representative Gutwald, for bringing it forward. And I know we have other testifiers who might like to have other opinions as Minnesotans, and so I would yield the rest of the time to them as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, we have two more brief questions and then move to our testifiers. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to the need or not need of a fiscal note, I do know that in past legislation, the legislators felt that even though a coal moratorium would open up the possibility of litigation from the Dakotas over preventing their facility from exporting power into our state, that was sort of considered part of the Attorney General's job. On the topic of constitutionality, I take my oath to the Constitution seriously, and I know that there are many people through history that have taken their oath seriously, and they also realize that if something is unlawful or unconstitutional and they take a stand, they take the hit for it. And I have no problems with taking a constitutional stand and taking the hit for it. And I think states' rights is much worth the possible risk and cost, because that's one of the main things that this country was founded on. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, I also appreciate you bringing this bill forward. And, you know, just back to that 2.20 about the Attorney General taking action and a fiscal note, I would encourage you that if that was the case, that you came up with a fiscal note, that you would weigh that Attorney General cost compared to the cost of imposition by the Unaffordable Care Act. I'm sorry, the Affordable Care Act. And the debt... and the damage it would do to our health care system. And I think there would be billions of dollars of savings, and the net result would be better health care for our citizens and actually more people insured under the bill. Any comments, Representative Gottwald?
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I appreciate the comments. There are, in fact, many costs to the state of Minnesota of implementing this, and that's just part of the concern. Granted, the bill, and we are, you know, our protocol is to speak to the bill. This bill simply states that we are invoking states' rights under the U.S. Constitution. This is 10th Amendment stuff, and it is very important. And I repeat again, I bring this bill forward not in, you know, not just as a political ploy or anything else. I am bringing this bill forward because it is a very, very serious issue, and it will have long and lasting impacts to the state of Minnesota depending on what we do. I recognize there are going to be legitimate differences of opinion on this, but... it says what it says. This is a declaration of our independence from what we believe is unconstitutional language within the ACA.
Okay, members, we have our first testifier. If you want to state your name and identify who you represent and give your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I am president of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And because I'm not sure exactly how long this hearing is going to go, I think it's important for me to point out all the people in this room, if they would wave, who are here, who totally believe in freedom and who totally believe in freedom, and thus I'm sure they support this bill. Unfortunately, they're here for the next bill, which they do not support. But so if you see someone with a white tag on, they are they're here because they love freedom. So let me begin by saying that I am pleased to come today on behalf of our organization to support House File 199, the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. A version of this act has been enacted in 6 states and embedded in the state constitutions of 2 states. Freedom is the essence of America, and freedom of choice in healthcare is an especially critical right because healthcare and the individual's right to life are inextricably linked. The freedom to choose doctors, treatments, medication, and insurance can make a difference in the quality and length of each patient's life. Patients must never have their hands tied or their lives jeopardized by laws that restrict contracts. That said, Congress already forbids private payment by Medicare patients for care denied. In light of the $500 billion cut to Medicare through Obamacare, this bill could stand as a legal source of hope for seniors who aren't allowed to pay for the cash for the care that they need. I am pleased to see that House File 199 acknowledges the ultimate law of the land, the U.S. Constitution, and the prescribed sovereignty of individuals and states within it. While the Constitution expressly limits what federal governments can do, what the federal government can do, and thus does not allow Obamacare to be implemented in any way, it's increasingly clear that states must protect citizens from federal encroachment, including Obamacare. Chairman Gottwald's legislation stands up against this encroachment, protecting the constitutional rights of Minnesota families, individuals, and patients over medical and insurance decisions. House File 199 also preserves the private contract between patient and doctor and patient and hospital. Whereas the federal law unconstitutionally imposes on individuals a mandate to purchase government-approved health insurance regardless of the cost, and despite any personal objections to the coverage requirements or the imposed limits on coverage, the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act promises to uphold the individual's right to say no to such coverage, including the automatic enrollment of individuals into Medicaid, which is part of Obamacare. House File 199 will also give individuals the freedom to avoid the IRS penalty for not purchasing government-approved insurance. It will allow individuals to buy health insurance that meets their personal and financial preferences. It will allow patients to pay cash for care and doctors to accept cash for care. It will also allow Minnesotans to keep their health care dollars out of the hands of health plans if they so choose. For those who do not know it yet, the federal health care reform law outlaws traditional high-deductible major medical health insurance for everyone over the age of 29, essentially giving the entire health insurance industry to managed care corporations. This bill gives individuals the freedom to say no to the HMO. For all these reasons, Citizens Council for Health Freedom supports House File 199, the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Question from Representative Liebling? Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, are you finished, Ms. Yes. Brace? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I think we're well off of this bill, really, and Ms. Braze's testimony, you know, her ringing condemnation of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, you know, everybody here is concerned about freedom, and I guess freedom is what you think it is. And, you know, how is that defined for different people? Well, I'll tell you, for a lot of people, freedom means not having your health care canceled when you have it, or being able to buy health care when you have a pre-existing condition. It means not having your care canceled when you're sick and you need the coverage so that you don't go bankrupt and lose your home. It means being able to insure your child who has a pre-existing condition. It means being able to keep your young adult on your own health care policy so that they don't go uninsured up until they're 26 years old. And these are all things that are in the Affordable Care Act. Now, I have to say that I was not in favor, personally, of what's called the individual mandate. But the individual mandate, for those in the room, is a piece that's necessary or was felt to be necessary in order to get these other really good benefits and to really make sure that the abuses of the healthcare insurance industry were controlled. Now, I don't think there's anybody here that believes that it's a perfect solution, that the law is perfect. There are a lot of things that are going to need to be adjusted and changed as time goes on. And there's really no large change that is perfect when it's first passed. We know this. You know, any large piece of legislation does have to be adjusted and changed as people find out how well it works or doesn't work for various things. But, you know, the freedom to have health insurance, to the freedom to receive health care when you need it, is also a very important freedom. And this is this legislation, or I shouldn't call it that, I'm taking up what other people are calling it, this law, our new law that we have and that we in Minnesota are trying to implement the best way as we can to make it work for our citizens here. This law is going to give freedom to a lot of people, and that is the freedom to be able to pick insurance in a healthcare exchange where they can actually see what they're buying, know what they're getting, and have health care when they need it. And those are very important freedoms too, Ms. Braze. So I just want to say this is not a matter of somebody who wants this to vote for this bill likes freedom and somebody who votes against it doesn't like freedom. For me, it's freedom for people to have coverage and not to go bankrupt from health care costs. And to me, that's a really important freedom.
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, if I could respond briefly. I'll go back to my opening comments. We in Minnesota have proposals in this legislative session and in previous sessions that have helped us become one of the leaders in the nation in this regard. Healthcare reform is something we can handle without unconstitutional provisions from the federal government. And I think if we want to focus on the text of this bill, it is focused on 10th Amendment rights, and regardless, we can disagree, Representative Liebling, about what this bill does or doesn't do from your perspective, and you may be a big fan of the ACA. I kind of sense that. But the truth of the matter is it does violate states' rights. This is being tested in the courts. Courts have found portions of it and all of it unconstitutional. This is headed for the U.S. Supreme Court. Minnesota has an obligation to protect the legitimate rights of its citizens when it comes to these matters. It needs to be done constitutionally. We all share the goal of better access to high-quality, cost-effective health care, but we have got to do it in a way that is respectful of states and individuals' rights.
Madam Chair.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to offer a few comments about what we talked about earlier in regards to the comment that freedom is what we think it is. I think for me, freedom, unfortunately, lately is what the courts think it is, and that's why we're in the situation we're in today, because the courts have ruled certain freedoms to be unconstitutional. And so we, as a legislative body and people, legislators representing people, need to stand up for our rights, and this is a perfect example of us standing up for our rights as people. And so with that, I guess I don't know what the correct definition of freedom is, but I go to the people that do know. And not to be too melodramatic, but a certain person said many years ago that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that this government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And that's what we're about. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Brace, as a follow-up to that?
Well, actually, as a response to Representative Liebling, Madam Chair. Is she there? Oh, there she is. Representative Liebling, I understand and I can see your concern for people, and I'm not doubting that whatsoever. But the fact of the matter is that the Constitution doesn't provide and guarantee those sorts of things for individuals, but it gives you the freedom and gives everyone the freedom to be able to do their best and to work with their providers and to work with their hospitals to make health care as inexpensive as they need to get it. What we have had happen in this country is that Congress gave the health care system over to the HMOs and health care corporations. So in this, we may or may not agree, but we don't want the power to be with the corporations. We want the power to be with the purse of individuals and not to have all the money and no other options but health plans. Because some of these bills that are coming up, the next one, for instance, talks only about health plans. And the federal law talks only about health plans and actually outlaws true insurance. So I think that we agree that people are perhaps paying too much and they don't have enough choices. But the reason goes back to Congress. And I wrote an article that is called Blame Congress for HMOs. And it talks about the same thing. What I think we really need is freedom, including freedom from the directives of Congress that gave us the power of the HMO and the health plan.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think probably I appreciate the comments, especially Representative Barrett, your reading to us from our original founding document. But probably the thing that I find is just amazing with the Affordable Care Act is the insinuation that the federal government has to do with that there aren't enough people here in Minnesota to care or have the intelligence to deal with our own state, and as if there aren't options, and almost like we're just incompetent, so they have to come in and just dominate and take over and just do that. And boy, you talk about the fundamentals of a country and our state. And so probably one of the things that in the last couple of years, having served on the Health and Human Services Finance Committee and other things, and working on healthcare working groups, Representative Geldof, my question for you is portrayed as sometimes like this ACA is the only way to do it, but I think I have a lot of confidence here in Minnesota that we have other options, and could you maybe give us a few options?
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, thank you for the question. We do have other options, and they've come forward in a bipartisan way. We've seen numerous proposals that, again, have given Minnesota the health care lead. Now, we have some, I'm not sure what you might be referring to, but we do have some. I've already talked with both the federal officials as well as state administrative officials that combined can give us things like guaranteed issuance and more affordable approaches that make promises we can keep with money we do have instead of promises we can't keep with money we don't have. These are within our power without the federal government's intervention to enact. We can do this and end up with, as close to possible, the most people covered. We often talk about complete insurance, total employment. 100% employment is not realistic because there's always a few percentage of people who won't be employed for whatever reason. So total employment is always viewed as a few percentage points of unemployment. In much the same way, we can use some of these tools that are at our disposal without federal intervention to get much, much closer to that sort of number for Minnesota in terms of people covered for health care. We do not need to do unconstitutional things to address the kind of challenges we face in health care.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to take a point of personal privilege here for just a moment and recognize former Representative Fran Bradley, who was my representative years ago and is in the room today watching the proceedings. And he also was chair of this and the Finance Healthcare Committees for many, many years. Representative Bradley.
Pleasure to have you here, Representative Bradley. One last question before we move on to our next testifier. Oh, I'm sorry. Two more questions. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a statement here, not addressed to really anybody, but I think a lot of us wouldn't have to have had run or felt the need to run for office had it not been for our freedom slowly being stripped away. And that's debatable what freedom is, to each his own. But I look at the Constitution. That's the document that I follow along with the Bible. And I have a family to support and a family that I have to take care of. And when I see that my children's future is looking bleaker than what I'm looking at today, that causes me some grave concern. And I don't see any hope. I don't see any change with the Affordable Care Act. What I see is our freedoms being taken away, being forced to buy a product that we may not need as a family. And I think that is that's a decision that each family may have. Minnesota, we need to just tell the federal government that we are not in agreement with this and move forward without being mandated by the federal government to purchase something that we don't agree with. And it's really sad that we have to actually say that we're fighting for our freedoms here in 2011 when there's so much other things that we could be working on here. But that's all.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Twice since this term has started, when we have been discussing legislation and public health programs and private insurance, the argument has been made that some believe Minnesotans or Americans are incompetent to make their own choices. And that was language that was just described to the Affordable Care Act, that somehow the federal government needed to step in because we are incompetent. And I want to reject that language in the strongest terms. We may have disagreements about the merit of the Affordable Care Act. We obviously do. But I did not support that legislation because I believe I, or anyone at this table, or anybody in Minnesota is incompetent to make decisions on their own. So I just want that to be clearly on the record. That is unacceptable language from my perspective. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just want to say just briefly that if we forget our history, we are doomed to repeat it. And with that said, I just want to remind us all that, of course, we know that Massachusetts has done their own plan and that increased the cost of health care by over 42%. So I caution us to not adopt this so quickly, the ACA, and try to do our own and or block it from the state of Minnesota. And just I'll close with some of the most unlikely folks that you would think would have a definition of freedom, and I think you'll appreciate this, because we are all free, and I think we're all here because we serve our country and our state, and we want to do whatever is best for the prosperity and health of all of us, of all the state, no matter what side of the aisle or table we sit on. So just remember this in closing, because I think we have to close pretty quickly. A free America means just this: individual freedom for all, rich or poor, or else this system of government we call democracy is only an expedient to enslave to the machine and make them like it. From Frank Lloyd Wright. So whatever you call freedom is, remember, we can make our own destiny, and we definitely don't need the federal government to impose theirs on what we call Minnesota's greatest health in the nation.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond, Representative Franson, to your what you said about being forced to buy something that we don't want. You know, under the Affordable Care Act, no one is going to be forced to buy a particular insurance product. What you will be asked to do, or forced to do, I guess, if you want to say, is to have some kind of coverage. That's all. Not telling you what to buy, but just that you have to have some. And the reason for that is that if you don't provide for yourself, the rest of your neighbors end up providing for you. So it does not, as I understand it, tell you what to buy. It does do some things to make the marketplace easier so that you can choose. Because one of the problems that people have now is if you're in the individual market, it's very, very hard to compare policies. You're not comparing apples to apples. And, you know, sometimes, I'll tell you, sometimes I go out to buy something, and like a computer, say, and the choices overwhelm me, and I come home without the thing I wanted to buy because it's so hard to understand what you're buying, and you want to know that you're getting value for your money. Well, what the Affordable Care Act is trying to do, and we'll see how successful it will be, but one of the things it's trying to do is make it easier for people to decide what is going to work best for them and to buy that. But the reason that we have this individual mandate is that if some people decide not to buy any insurance, their health, and then they get sick, their health costs end up on the rest of us. And so this is an individual responsibility thing. That's why this is in the Affordable Care Act, folks. Because if some people just decide that they're not going to do their part, not going to provide for themselves, the rest of the folks end up paying for it. And this happens now. When people go to the hospital and they don't have insurance, and their care ends up being absorbed by the hospital, they call it uncompensated care, that cost gets passed on to everyone else, and you're paying for it in your insurance rates. So the idea is that when you have, if everybody, healthy or sick, buys into the insurance pool, the risk is spread, and everyone is doing their share, and that's the idea. Now, I don't like the idea either of it being an individual mandate, and I understand there are some ideas out there to perhaps have a different way of doing this so that everybody is in the pool without having to say to individuals, you must buy insurance. But this is not telling you what to buy, just that you have to buy something so that you provide for your own costs to the extent that you're able. And don't just say, oh, I'm not going to get sick. I'm going to just wait till I'm sick before I buy insurance. We had a presentation about this some weeks ago, and I think from the insurance brokers who were explaining to us that what they do is get healthy people into the pool to spread the risk. And that is something that the Affordable Care Act is trying to do, make sure everyone's in the pool so that some people's costs don't fall on everybody else. So you can look at it as being forced to buy. I look at it as everybody taking responsibility for their own costs.
Representative, I'm sorry, Ms. Brace.
Thank you so much. Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, maybe we have different definitions of the government not telling us what we have to buy, because as you were talking, I just made up a list. First of all, it's got to be a government-approved policy, so not just any policy that you want to. Second of all, catastrophic coverage has been outlawed, which means the policy that I have, I will no longer be able to have. Third, it's got to be bronze, silver, gold, platinum, so they decide what the coverage is and you have to buy it. Fourth, it's health plans only, not true catastrophic insurance. Fifth, Secretary Sebelius decides what we all have to pay for. She is fiat authority to decide what's in every health plan that's offered. And sixth, the costs are going to go up as a result of this, and we don't have any choice. As a matter of fact, I think it was the CBO who said the costs of individual and small group policies are going to go up 10 to 13% higher.
So we are indeed being forced to buy a certain product by the government because we cannot buy anything except what the government tells us we have to buy. We may have a small choice in there, and maybe it's your preference to go to a store where there are only a few choices so you can have it easier to choose. But I think individuals in this country have the right to have as many choices as they want, as people are willing to provide them, and to make their choices on their own. But this, the Affordable Care Act doesn't do that. It limits the choices.
Okay, members, we do have one final testifier that we're going to hear from. We have two questions. Would you, Representative Benson, I know that you're on the list. Would you like to, you can make your brief comment or question, then we're going to move to the last testifier and take a vote before 4:15.
Yeah, just a brief comment.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've heard it as a choice, and you know, I'm not directing it necessarily at Representative Liebling, but the fact is that we call a choice being forced to pay for something even if we're given a palette of things that we can choose from. Just the fact that we have to choose from the palette is an abridgment of my freedom. You know, I've got to still select something, and I think I think one of the things that's being lost in this whole argument here is that what we see eventually with the Accountable Care Act is that there will be the eventual destruction of the private insurance market as we know it, and ultimately this leading to a single-payer system. And, I know it hasn't been said yet, and I know we've got a short amount of time, but I think that's the element that's being left out of this whole, is the destruction of the private care market and an eventual having to move to a single-payer system. That's all my comments. Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer, briefly.
Rather, we have our testifier.
Okay, wonderful. And Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question for Ms. Braze, if she'd be willing to come back. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms.
Representative Murphy.
You know, the thing that's tricky about the mandate is that it creates a pool, as Representative Liebling was explaining. And I know that there are people that don't want to have to purchase coverage. But my question is, would it be okay then if we're going to say people don't have to buy coverage, is it time for us then to say providers don't have to provide care? Are we at that place where providers can deny care so we are de facto choosing rationing?
Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy. I actually believe that as a result of the way that our system is going, we are going to have less providers willing to be providers. We are going to have providers who are going to choose to retire early. We're going to have students who won't decide to be doctors because, after all, why would you want to go all the way through medical school, 11, 15 years, only to have the government tell you how to practice medicine? Everybody in their right mind would decide that they'd only have 4 years of education to do something that was 9 to 5. So I think what we're getting to is a point where doctors are, it would be good to free doctors actually to work with patients at prices that patients can afford. And therefore, I think we'd have happier doctors, better access, less cost, and happier patients.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Ms. Brazet, I appreciate that, and I understand that perspective, but I don't think you really answered my question. So if we say that it is okay and we shouldn't require that people have coverage, so then it's up to the individual. And those individuals that choose not to have coverage present at a hospital or to a doctor, should the hospital or doctor be able to turn that person away because of their inability to pay, thus rationing?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brace.
And Representative Murphy. Every individual should be free. We should not be conscripting physicians to provide care. But the fact of the matter is, I believe that people who need care will be grateful for the charity of individuals if the doctors are free to provide charity services. And as a matter of fact, I believe that the way we're moving now with $500 billion taken out of Medicare, there's probably going to be a lot of Medicare patients that are going to go to doctors looking for charity that Medicare won't provide for them. So every doctor needs to be free, because after all, the doctor can choose not to become a doctor. And what you really want to have is you want to have a patient and a doctor working together.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Brace, I think that's a yes. Thank you.
Representative Gottwalt. Representative Huntley, a brief comment before our last testifier.
Mr. Chair and our Madam Chair, and this is for Representative Gottwalt, and I'm interested in lines 2.7 to 2.13, where it says State of Minnesota, blah, 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 regarding all rights, persons residing in the state and choosing a mode of securing health services. So we can't mandate that. That's the state policy according to that section. And then subsection B says it's public policy of the state of Minnesota, consistent with our constitutionally recognized and inalienable rights of liberty, is that every person within the state of Minnesota is and shall be free to choose or decline to choose any mode of securing health services. So, Representative Gottwalt, does that mean if we pass this that we will no longer be able to mandate that a divorced parent supply his child with health care as part of the divorce decree?
Representative Gottwalt.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I think this language, again, is in addressing 10th Amendment rights. I believe it says the state shall retain its right to determine these things and allow individuals within the state to determine their own choices. Now, we as a state, representing the individuals in our state, have passed laws regarding those things. I don't see that this supersedes it unless there's a judge in the room who can tell me otherwise. So, I would not think that that would have the impact you're saying, Mr. Huntley.
Representative Huntley.
And it does say it's the state policy. So, given those lines 2.7 to 2.13, you want to talk about constitutionality. Nobody in Massachusetts even sued over the constitutional mandate. Secondly, and given the kind of language you've been using, I was going to say Medicare, but I think I'll call it Johnson Care. Does this section of the these lines, would that permit a person in Minnesota to opt out of Medicare? Because the federal law says that everybody gets in Medicare and they pay for it with a premium tax, a tax on them and their employer. So would that be, why is that not unconstitutional?
Representative Gottwalt.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I don't think there's anything in this bill that speaks to that. I disagree with your interpretation unless you've got a JD and can show me how this, in fact, is unconstitutional. I don't know that we've had any federal judge rule on that either. So,
members, my apologies to Dr. Geis. I don't know if you have some comments that you could make in about 30 seconds, and then we are going to go to a vote within the next 2 minutes.
I'm Dr. Robert Geis, practiced in St. Paul for a number of years, Madam Chair and committee members, and thanks for hearing me out for 30 seconds. I got 25 left. I want you to support this bill, and I have read it and think it's a good piece of legislation. The problems I see is with the mandate, it's good intentions gone awry. The problems with good intentions to have everybody be able to afford health services is wonderful. I'm for it. However, you can do it in a couple of ways. This one is the bad way, and there's a good way, but we don't have time for that one. So let's talk about whether this would work or not. Let's not fly from 30,000 feet over philosophy and so forth, or the name of the bill and so forth. But let's see, does it work? We have a paradigm state where it has been in place in Massachusetts. You're all familiar with that. And what happens in Massachusetts when you did have the mandate? You had to fix the prices of the premiums so they were affordable. That meant you then had to fix the prices of all the benefits. They also said that because it's a mandate, you have what's called guaranteed issue. That means anybody can have it anytime they request it. Well, this was all fine and well, but what was the result? You couldn't get rid of eligibility requirements because mandated for everybody. And what you could do is a number of other things, which they've tried to do. What's the result has been is Massachusetts has had a terrible problem with cost, quality, and access. And I would suggest that when you have a mandate, you end up with lots of cost, which has been demonstrated in Massachusetts in spades. You then have lack of access because you get the system overrun with demand, and you have poor quality when you can't get to your clinic. It's filled, but you have to go to the ER instead, and in Massachusetts, up goes the ER visits, not down as was promised. So again, I would suggest that you pass this bill, and I must be over by at least 5 seconds, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Geist, and my apologies to you and other testifiers. It was a good discussion today, members. Representative Gottwalt, final comment?
Madam Chair, I will renew my motion that House File 199 pass as amended and be referred to the Government Operations and Elections Committee.
Representative, we're going to move to a vote here, members. I'm Representative Franzen? Okay. Representative Gottwalt renews his motion that House File 199 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Representative Kwan? Roll call?
Roll call being requested. Representative Kwan has requested a roll call. There will be a roll call. Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Gottwalt.
Aye.
Mack.
Aye.
Abler?
Yes.
Barrett?
Yes.
Benson?
Yes.
Franzen?
Yes.
Fritz?
No.
Runhagen?
Yes.
Hosh?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Kiffmeyer?
Aye.
Liebling?
No.
Loeffler?
No.
Lohmer?
Yes.
McDonald?
Yes.
McElpatrick?
Yes.
Moran?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Norton?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Guam?
Aye.
There being 12 ayes and 9 nays, the motion prevails and the bill as amended is adopted and re-referred to the passed and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Members, we had talked about coming back at 6 o'clock. I understand there are a number of things going on, and we are not going to do that. I apologize to people who are here to testify for the next bill that will be rescheduled, and there will be an opportunity for you to testify on it again, but we are out of time. Members, there being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.